Good morning and happy Wednesday, January the 8th. I'm Joy Cardine. January the 9th, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's about 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. We spent the first couple of our hours this morning talking politics and the results of the New Hampshire primary. We'll take a break from presidential politics for this hour, though. Though our subject this hour is political to some extent, it's food. We're pleased to have with us author Michael Pollan, who you have heard before on Wisconsin Public Radio, talking about his previous books, like The Botany of Desire and more recently The Omnivore's Dilemma, where he examined where our food comes from and what goes into getting food to our tables and the toll that it can take on us and on the planet. Well, he takes The Omnivore's Dilemma to another level in his latest book, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, where he advises us to eat food, not too much, mostly plants. It sounds simple enough. Do you already follow this advice? We'll find out, though, this hour that by food, Michael Pollan means real food, well-grown food, unprocessed food. We'll find out what difference that makes, and we will welcome your thoughts and your questions for Michael Pollan. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Michael Pollan is the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley. He is the author of several books, including The Omnivore's Dilemma and the recently published In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Well, you gave away the end of the book in the very first few lines. Eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Yeah, I could have, you know, just published an index card. Because I was, after all, you know, a couple of years of this research, I was able to boil it all down to seven words, my little haiku. But the problem is, it's not so easy to distinguish the real food from the fake food, so the advice is a little less easy than it sounds.
Right. And why is this in defense of food? Why does food need defending?
Because food is under attack or being undermined from two sides. One, from nutritional science, which is encouraging us to ignore foods and pay attention to nutrients, which are not the same thing. I submit that foods are not the sum of their nutrient parts. And it's also under attack or being undermined by the food industry, which just cannot leave well enough alone, and is always busy taking, you know, real foods, traditional foods, things we all know and have known for a long time, and tricking them up into very complicated food products. I mean, it's the move from yogurt to Go-Gurt, portable yogurt tubes, is a classic example.
Well, what's wrong with Go-Gurt?
It's not food. It's interesting, but it's not food. Because it's, you know, yogurt was fine the way it was. You know, some milk and bacterial culture. It didn't need 15 other ingredients to simulate the feeling of fat, to, you know, simulate the taste of a strawberry or bubble gum or whatever they're doing. It also didn't need to be put in a tube so kids can squirt it in their mouth on the school bus. We used to eat food at tables where you didn't need tubes.
Yeah, so let's take these the nutrition scientists and the food industry separately.
Sure.
The food industry is making all this fake food because it wants to sell it.
Well, yeah, the food industry has a problem, and that is that it's hard to make money selling whole foods. You know, if you think about cereal grains, you think about oatmeal. You know, it's very cheap grain; it's a commodity. You can buy for 79 cents a pound at my market. You can buy a pound of organic oats. When you have a commodity like that, one manufacturer, one grower can't distinguish theirs from another, and the price is always falling because agricultural output is steadily going up. So you can't make any money unless you add value, unless you process the food. So you turn that oatmeal into Cheerios, and that's one big step. And suddenly you're getting $4 for a couple pennies worth of grain because you've given it that neat little shape and the name and the brand and all that kind of stuff. But then that becomes a commodity with a falling price as, you know, all the house brands of all the supermarkets make their own Cheerios. So then you take your Cheerios and you make a cereal bar, you know, a new novel product with even more processing. One of those little bars that kids can take to school, or you can eat in the car with a layer of fake milk in between. And suddenly you're charging many, many dollars per pound for your grain because you're selling convenience and you're selling novelty. So the industry has this, you know, this unavoidable imperative of processing food more and more, trying to add value to these cheap agricultural commodities. The problem is, even though that's good business, it's not good biology, because the more you process food, the more you remove the nutrients from it. And these, the more processed these foods are, the less good they are for us.
Yeah. So you don't want us to eat Cheerios?
Cheerios are fine. Cheerios is a relatively simple food, but I would avoid those cereal bars and probably the cereal straws, which is the next iteration in processing cereal grain.
Straws.
Have you seen these things?
No.
They take the cereal material and they extrude it in the shape of a straw, and then they line it with something that looks like milk. It's this white substance. And then the idea is, I think, that children drink milk through these straws and then eat the straw.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, no, I have not seen those. But there's got to be some B vitamins or something in those cereal straws that are good for kids.
Well, the interesting thing is they do fortify all those things. And a lot of processed food gets fortified with vitamins. But the reason it has to be fortified is that the processing took out the vitamins to begin with. Whole grain has all those vitamins, you know, to start with. And that's one of the problems with processing food. It tends to take out the nutrients. We put back in the nutrients we recognize that are missing. But who knows what else we don't recognize when we fool around with whole grain?
Yeah.
I mean, we've only recognized, you know, some portion of all the nutrients that are in food.
Yeah, you think we're a little bit nutrient-obsessed anyway.
Well, yeah, we are. I mean, you know, nutrients are kind of interesting, but they're invisible. Focusing on nutrients implies you know what the important ones are. It implies you know how to measure them. And it implies they work the same way in isolation as they do in the context of a food. But in fact, we know this isn't the case. When we try to take things like calcium or beta-carotene or some of the other vitamins out of the context of a food and put them into supplement form, they don't seem to work the same way. Sometimes they don't work at all. And we don't really know why that's true. But it may be that nutrients have to work in concert with other nutrients to have their effect. So nutrients aren't the same as the foods that they contain. It's one thing to eat foods containing beta-carotene, like carrots, which seem to be very good for us, and quite another to eat a beta-carotene pill, which doesn't seem to do anything.
Yeah. So how have the nutrition scientists heard our diets?
Well, they haven't deliberately, you know, they didn't set out to hurt our diets, and there are ways in which they've helped. By isolating certain vitamins, they help deal with deficiency diseases, and there are vitamins, if you're deficient, if you take them in pill form, you'll be better. The nutritionists have hurt our diet by taking the focus off of whole foods, and it's understandable that they would do that, because it's very hard to study whole foods. You know, this is how Western science works. You reduce things to its component parts, and you need to isolate single variables so you can test whether they do anything or not. But even though that's how Western science has to work, it's not how food works. So this focus on nutrients that, you know, that they're doing for their own reasons has been picked up on by the media and by the food companies. You see, the food companies love this nutrient focus, because they can play this nutrient game really well. And they can redesign their processed foods to fit the latest nutritional fashion. So if omega-3 is the hot nutrient today, as it is, they're figuring out ways to put omega-3 in your milk, in your orange juice, in your yogurt. I mean, take a look at the store right now.
Yeah.
It's showing up everywhere.
Yeah, I got some eggs the other day that had omega-3s in them.
Well, that's done not by supplementing so much as changing the diet of the chickens and giving them a lot of flaxseed. And so, you see, if you're playing the processed food game, you can adjust your nutrients. You can dial back on the bad ones and dial up on the good ones. And whole foods can't play that game. They're kind of stuck. Whatever, you know, broccoli is, it's always going to be. You can't change the dial. So it gives the processors of food an opportunity to at least imply that they've got the healthiest stuff in the store, when that is not the case.
Yeah. Well, you're advising mostly plants in our diet. Isn't meat a whole food?
Yeah, meat is a whole food, and that's why I say mostly.
Mm-hmm.
We eat way too much meat, though. We're eating more than 200 pounds a person. There are a lot of reasons not to eat quite that much meat, not to eat meat at, you know, three meals a day. And that is that people who eat lots of meat, especially red meat, do have worse health outcomes in terms of cancer and heart disease. But it's not to say meat is an unhealthy food. In moderation, it's a very nutritious food. There's no good nutritional reason to exclude meat from the diet. It's got all the amino acids you want, and people have been eating meat. You know, our species have been eating meat for tens of thousands of years. It clearly agrees with us. We go to great trouble to get it, and we always have. But we have made it so cheap and so accessible that we eat it all the time. And it hasn't, you know, it not only takes a toll on our body, but it takes a huge toll on the environment. The ecological footprint of meat eating is probably even more serious than the ecological footprint of your car.
Yeah. We are talking about eating for better health, for more pleasure, for ourselves, for our planet, with Michael Pollan, author of the new book, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. Do you agree with Michael Pollan that the food industry and nutrition experts have us on a bad diet, a diet of too much food, too much processed foods, too much meat? Do you try to do as Michael suggests, to eat only real, whole, well-grown food, not too much of it, and mostly plants? Why or why not? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. You just heard that in our next hour, Kathleen Dunn and her guests will be examining the results of the New Hampshire primary. There will be a special this afternoon on Talk of the Nation after 1 o'clock, and also Ben Marin's after 4 o'clock. So plenty of chances to talk about the New Hampshire primary results and where the race for the White House goes from here, coming up later today on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about food and eating the right foods, eating non-processed foods, talking with Michael Pollan, whose latest book is called In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. Michael Pollan will be in Wisconsin next week on Monday, January the 14th. He'll be speaking at Alverno College in Milwaukee, Monday, January 14th at 7 p.m. which is an event that's also sponsored by the Harry Schwartz Bookshop. And we'll take your calls from Michael Pollan at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our first caller is Rena in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Michael. Hi.
Hi, Rena.
I just wanted to say I've always grown up with I come from a third world country, and I've grown up with fish and vegetables, and I've always found it to be the very ideal food. And again, having it healthy, not processed, I think it's very important. We already are putting so much food in our body that our body doesn't have a chance to even rest, to cleanse itself. And I've always find having a lighter food, such as vegetable and fish, has always worked for me. I guess my question is, how do you get society to move toward that, knowing there are a lot of excuses? I'm too busy. I can't cook. Yeah. I can't grow my fish. I can't go get the vegetable. What do you suggest?
Well, I think you've got your finger on the problem there, that we have been seduced into this culture of convenience foods. And we tell ourselves we don't have time to buy whole foods, because if you buy whole foods, you do have to cook them. And we've had this, you know, 50-year experiment in outsourcing food preparation to corporations. And it just has failed us because they're not cooking very well for us. They're not cooking with an eye to our health. So it seems to me inescapable that if people want to eat well, they will have to put a little bit more into food. That's both in terms of money and more importantly in terms of time, and that we need to rediscover cooking. Now, cooking, you know, when you say that word to people, they they react in horror, you know, as if you've asked them to do something incredibly hard. But of course, cooking, you know, needn't be that hard or that complicated. I think we've been dazzled by you know, cooking shows that show it as this Olympian feat. And but I don't know about you, but you know, if you've got good ingredients, as you say, you know, some fish and some vegetables, you can put a really good meal on the table in 20 minutes.
Yeah. Rena, thanks very much for the call. One of my New Year's resolution, I am going to take a cooking class, and it's a seafood cooking class because we are trying to eat more fish, and I'm trying to prepare it myself rather than pick it up at a restaurant or something like that. What about, though, the fish, the farmed fish versus the wild-caught fish and all the other bad fish?
Well, yeah, there are a lot of issues with fish, mm-hmm. and fish used to be a simple question. But basically, if you can get wild fish, it's usually better. I mean, wild salmon is far better than farm salmon. And in the case of salmon, the wild is actually more nutritious, too. It has more omega-3s in it, and because they're feeding the farmed fish things like, you know, corn, and which is not the natural diet of a fish. You know, it's interesting. The advice in this book to eat, you know, well-grown food from healthy soils, every good choice for your health is a very good choice for the environment, with one exception, and that is fish. You know, if everybody in this country were to begin eating the amounts of fish we probably should eat for our health, the fisheries would just crash. So we have to be careful about the fish we choose. And there are some fish that are in good supply. And, in fact, wild salmon from Alaska, if you can find it, is a very sustainably managed fishery. But there are fish that are, you know, crashing. And we have to be careful what we choose. And, you know, you can get those little cards from the Marine mm-hmm. Stewardship Council or your local aquarium. And they point you to the good ones. We shouldn't overlook those oily little fish like sardines and things like that and mackerel, because those have lots of good nutrients and they're not in danger. But you know, they're working on sustainable fish aquaculture, and they will get it down, I'm sure. The aquaculture for shellfish is fairly sustainable, I think. But some of the others are not. Shrimp, for example, you're better off if you can get wild shrimp than farm shrimp. But in general, you know, fish is a good choice. Fish yeah. is a very good choice for your health.
What's for dinner tonight, Michael?
You know, I'm on book tour, so yeah. I never know what's for dinner. It's like, what's on the hotel bar menu when I get back at 11 o'clock?
And it's, yeah, you don't have to do this if you're traveling, because that's kind of hard to cook your own meal then.
Although I try, because you can really get into trouble with restaurant food. And it's so late, usually, by the time I eat, that I try to stick to a couple appetizers. Entrees are so huge these days. And so I'll have a salad and perhaps some other little appetizer
yeah.
and call it a meal.
Renee in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, you're on the air.
Well, I just have a question on how, you know, pork is always advertised as the other white meat, and I'm just wondering if that's true, and is it healthier than red meat? And I guess I'll take my answers on
yeah.
the air.
Well, you know, pork is the other white meat was an effort beginning in the 80s and 90s to reduce the fat content of pork. So it could compete more effectively with chicken. And they did that by basically breeding leaner hogs. So lean, in fact, that they couldn't live outdoors anymore, and they had to move into confinement hog operations. You know, pork is closer to beef than to chicken in its fat profile, although it is not, you know, it's not a bad food. Too much of it. And I would avoid processed pork, things like bacon and things that have been smoked. There really is some evidence that eating a lot of processed meats is particularly bad. But, you know, the problem with the new white meat is this modern pork is it's tough as running shoes very often. And you're kind of better off with a pork that's been raised outside, you know, Nyman pork, for example, which is these animals still live outside. It's the more conventional genetics. And it's a little fattier, but it's a lot tastier. And if the animals are getting a good diet, there's some healthy fats there too. So we shouldn't, you know, just demonize meat fat. I mean, it really, you know, it can be nutritious too, depending on the diet of the animals. So if you can get like grass-fed beef or pastured pork, you know, animals that have lived outside and have eaten a lot of grass, and not just that diet of corn and byproducts, you know, that's much healthier fat than the other kind. All fat is not created equal.
Yeah. Well, I don't demonize animal fat, but I don't eat much of it. I'm more of a vegetarian, and there are a lot of people who are. I do have fish and no other meats. What about those products? They are fake foods, like, you know, fake meat products. Are those on
Yeah, the soy-based meat products. Well, soy is a funny issue. You know, we are eating a huge amount of soy now because of those kind of products and also because of soy oil, which most of our fast food is fried in. 20% of the calories in the average American diet now comes from soy oil alone. And then you add all those other soy products, and you're talking about a significant percentage of our calories. Soy has been a healthy food for thousands of years in Asia, but they eat it differently than we do. Mm-hmm. They eat it in a fermented form, or they eat it in, you know, tofu. Mm-hmm. They figured out some traditional ways to process it simply that make it very nutritious. We're eating it in very novel forms, such as, you know, isolated soy protein and various novelties like, you know, I don't know, tofu bacon and things like that, that I think the jury is still out on. I think that, you know, I'm kind of a reactionary when it comes to these things. If people haven't been eating it for a long time, I'd kind of rather let them do the experiment. So I stay away from those highly processed soy products.
Next, we go to Rob in Ashland. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Loved your book, The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Thank you.
That was great. About 4 years ago, my children had some food allergies, and we started going through allergy testing. And one of the things that they were allergic to, of course, was the corn. And we had a heck of a time trying to come up with a diet that didn't include some form of corn in it.
Yeah.
But once we did, it was amazing how their food allergies subsided. And I don't have any food allergies myself, but just that my general health improved by just removing that high fructose corn syrup out of our diet. I probably lost about 15 pounds without even trying.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and it's just been incredible. We've moved more towards a healthier food diet now, using whole foods and organics and things like that. But it's still really hard, even after doing this for 4 years, of consistently trying to find foods that don't have corn in it.
Yeah, well, corn is ubiquitous. You know, if you read Omnivore's Dilemma, it's ubiquitous in the American food supply. And it has taken over our food and our bodies and our landscape. And now it's going after our cars. But, you know, high fructose corn syrup is, I recommend looking for products, not buying products with high fructose corn syrup, not because it is inherently an unhealthy nutrient. It probably is no worse than table sugar. The problem with it is, though, is its ubiquity, the fact that it's in everything and that it's so cheap and so seductive to food scientists that they cannot leave it out. So it ends up in baked goods that were never sweetened before. It ends up in the condiments. It ends up in all the snack food, even the salty food, and gets a little shot of sugar. And you know, with the result that we're eating about 40 pounds more of it per person and per year. And so it is probably true that if you could simply remove that one nutrient from your diet, you could lose a lot of weight. If you look at what's changed in our diet since 1980, you know, we've added about 300 calories of to the average American's diet since then. Most of those calories have come in the form of high fructose corn syrup.
Michael Pollan, tell us about how the connection between this book and In Defense of Food and Omnivore's Dilemma.
Well, they are linked in a way. Omnivore's Dilemma dealt largely with the environmental and ethical implications of our food choices. This book deals with the health implications. This book is an attempt to figure out what do we really know about the links between diet and health, and knowing that, how should we make our food choices? It's a more practical book. It's a much shorter book, and it's really based on you know, the research I did for the other book really informed me about the nature of the American food supply and how we grow our food and where it comes from. And this book then is to say, well, okay, if you're concerned about your health, how should you eat? A lot of people who read that book had many questions and worries about how to eat. And I, you know, I had all these readers who would come up to me and say, I'm really afraid to finish your book because every time I turn the page, there's something else I shouldn't eat. And I'm afraid if I finish it, I'll starve to death.
So, there's plenty to eat, though, is what you're saying. But it's just,
there is plenty to eat. And, you know, we live in very good times when it comes to finding alternatives to industrial food. Better times than we've had for 40 years. You know, by advising people to eat whole foods, well-grown and good soils, and meat that's been well-grown the way the animal should be raised on the proper diet, you couldn't do this 40 years ago. You'd this would have been the manifesto of a crackpot, a back-to-the-lander growing all his own food. But now you have, you know, this explosion of interest in organic food. You've got farmers markets. You've got grass-fed beef producers, you know, all over the country doing quite well. And you have the Internet to help us track down some of this food in our local communities. So we're very lucky. There is an alternative food chain that's growing by leaps and bounds. And by patronizing that, by voting with our fork, we will make it bigger and we'll make the food cheaper, because right now it is very expensive.
Next, we go to Karen in Whitewater. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for this show. It's fascinating. I have, for several reasons, started my son several months ago on a gluten and casein-free diet. And it's been going very well. However, I've faced scrutiny from several individuals, particularly regarding the lack of enriched, the enriched flours. And I would like to know what Michael has to say about that.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. We do depend on now industry to replace these nutrients missing from our diet. But I think if your children are getting a diversified diet and if they're eating, you know, I don't know if they're eating any vegetables. It's often good. Well, if they're eating vegetables, they're going to be fine. And if you're worried, there's nothing wrong with giving them a vitamin supplement. To cover their bases. But you don't need to, you know, have commercial wheat in order to be healthy or fortified wheat. So, think about giving them a vitamin. And as long as you're getting your plants and your diet, your vegetables and your fruits, you're going to cover your bases in terms of vitamins.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the source of those vegetables, though. Some of us buy packaged spinach from California that every once in a while is contaminated.
Yeah, well, it's a good idea to cook it. That'll take care of that problem.
Well, sometimes you throw it in a salad.
I know. It's so good to eat raw. But, you know, I mean, there is some slight risk in that. We've seen that already.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many precautions are being taken now, and it's probably a cleaner product than it was last year for that reason. It's more important that we eat fruits and vegetables than we eat organic fruits and vegetables. I mean, the basic, you gain a lot from just the decision to eat fruits and vegetables. And then the next step is, if you want to go there, is, you know, paying attention to how they're grown. And then you have given yourself the benefit of more nutritious fruits and vegetables, because it appears in several recent studies that when you grow organic and conventional side by side, there are more beneficial nutrients in the organic, which stands to reason. I mean, if the soil is healthier, which is to say it's alive and fertile, it's going to contain much more complexity chemically than if you're just, you know, it's industrial soil that's just getting shots of NPK, you know, of commercial fertilizers, which tends to simplify the soil. Also, organic plants, and this is another theory why they might be more nutritious. Most of the good things in plants are defensive chemicals that the plants use to protect themselves, whether from oxygen or pests or diseases. And the organic ones have to defend themselves more since they're not being sprayed with pesticides, so they generate more of these good compounds. That's another theory. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, taking pesticides out of your diet is always a good idea. We shouldn't, you know, we carry a very high load of pesticides in our bodies, so anything we can do to diminish that is a good thing.
Yeah, you are a big fan, though, of farmers markets and those community-sponsored agriculture programs and buying local vegetables when you can.
Sure. Well, you know, the healthiest fruits and vegetables are the freshest ones. Mm-hmm. And very often, if you're buying produce from California, which I realize in the winter people don't have much choice mm-hmm. about, it's picked before it's ripe, which is to say before all the good chemicals have been constructed in that plant and shipped in that condition. But when it's picked fresh, and we know this, and when we taste a fresh tomato that was picked yesterday, it's incomparable. And all that complexity of flavor is mirrored in the complexity of nutrition. And so you can't do, you know, better than eating seasonal foods, that are grown locally. And the chances are, by the way, that it's, you know, being grown sustainably, because the small local farms are not huge monocultures that use lots of chemicals. And also less energy probably was used in getting it to your plate. And that's a positive thing, too.
BJ in Fond du Lac is with us now. Hi, BJ.
Good morning. Mike, I was wondering if you were, your last interview last week with Wisconsin Public Radio, I believe it was, Ralph Nader was on right after you, and I was wondering if you had heard that Ralph Nader had plugged your book. He went through your 12 steps.
You know, I heard that. Somebody told me that. I didn't hear it because I was in California, but the word got to me that he was talking about my 12 steps.
Yep, and I thought that was really nice of him, and he said that it wasn't a new idea.
No.
Because it's the new way of living. He was like, well, it is an old way, but it's just the fact that nobody's been living it that way for so long that it is somewhat of a new idea for the younger generation. So
I think that's right.
And you could find it on the archives, I believe. But my only beef was with what you had to say before, with that last interview, it was right at the end, was that you were basically saying you should be able to go just eat any vegetables, it shouldn't really matter. And I'm still in question about the genetically modified foods.
Yeah.
And knowing that they can cross-contaminate non-genetically modified foods, so even questioning that, you know, if you have an organic farm near a genetically modified farm, that your organic farming could be contaminated by that. And that's about all. So
okay.
Thank you very much, and I'm glad to hear what you've had to say.
Well, thank you for your question. You know, genetically modified crops, whatever you think of them, the fact is they're not in common fruits and vegetables, with the exception of the papaya. Most of the genetically modified crops are in corn and soy. And most of that corn and soy is processed or fed to livestock. So when you go to the produce section, it's not like you're navigating a landscape with lots of GMOs. As I said, the papaya is the one example because there was a problem with the virus that they solved using genetic techniques. It is true that organic farms are at risk of being contaminated with genes from GMO farms, and this is happening. The genes do not stay put in the GMO crops. They're, in the case of corn, they travel by wind. What effect this has on our health is not clear. There has not been much evidence to suggest that there are health problems tied to transgenic crops. On the other hand, I would not take too much comfort from that because there have not been tests. Very few feeding studies of GMO crops have been conducted. I mean, you would be amazed that these products were approved without more testing of health effects. There is the ever-present danger that these transgenic crops will produce new allergens. And there are people who believe that the high levels of food allergies out there are related, but there is no proof of that at all as yet. So, you know, given a choice, I avoid transgenic food just because it offers me no benefits and it carries a certain unknown risk. And so if you do a good cost-benefit analysis, you'd stay away. The problem is it's not labeled, so it's hard to stay away. And if you're buying processed food, you know, soy is in just about everything, you are exposing yourself to some transgenic food. If you buy organic, you are not, with the exception of these small amounts of contamination that are happening on some farms. So if it matters to you, it's a very strong argument for buying organic. But, you know, the larger point remains. We do not eat nearly enough fruits and vegetables in this country. If we did, we would reduce many of our health problems, you know, from weight to diabetes to cancer. And so, to me, the first priority is to get up the consumption of fruits and vegetables. Eat these plants, whatever their source. And then, if you can afford to and if you care, then pay attention to the source.
Our guest is Michael Pollan. He is the Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley. He is the author of many books. His most recent book is In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto, in which he advises us to eat food, real food, unprocessed food. Not too much of it, though, and mostly plants. Talking about eating for better health for ourselves and our planet. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn and her guests will examine the Republican and Democratic results from last night's New Hampshire primary. That's coming up after 9. We are talking with Michael Pollan. He is the author of In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. Michael Pollan will be in Milwaukee on Monday, January the 14th. He's coming to Wisconsin. He's going to be speaking at Alverno College at 7 o'clock at night on Monday, January the 14th. And this is an event sponsored by the Harry Schwartz Bookshop. I don't have a phone number or anything for to get more information, but I'm sure that if you go to Harry Schwartz or Alverno College, there's probably more information on their websites. Our next caller for him is Aaron in Eau Claire. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Mm-hmm. Michael, you're a personal hero to me, and I thank you for doing all that you're doing. Let me give you some background. We have a small co-op here. It's called Just Local Food. We started about 4 years ago, and as our name suggests, we focus on local food and really pretty much everything that you're espousing are principles that we, the workers, believe in. And one of the main challenges we found is education and awareness. And what you're doing, writing books, talking on the radio and telling people about this is absolutely crucial, because what we're up against is this profit-making food system that is actually really, really good at what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my main point is thank you, and we need more of it. But really, how can we overcome this? The education and it sometimes it seems insurmountable to me, because even regular customers of ours kind of still have these things in the back of their head that are false or wrong or misimpressions. And we've got a lot of great farms here in Wisconsin and, you know, doing a lot of really great things. We're so lucky. You mentioned spinach earlier. We've got a farm that's in northern Wisconsin that brings us fresh spinach every week, year round.
That's great.
And it is great. We need more of them. So how can we take on this big food system?
Well, I think the challenge is to go around this big food system. You know, I think that the big food system will not go away. The big food system has $32 billion to spend in marketing every year. That's a huge amount of money, and it's one of the reasons that you know, it has the microphone in a way, and its message gets across. The challenge is to get other messages across, and yeah, that is what I'm doing. I mean, that's a big part of my work, and luckily, it's the work of many other journalists, and many chefs around the country today are, you know, taking up the cause, and people like yourselves. I mean, there are people working on food policy, food activism, artisanal food production. You know, there's a real renaissance of this kind of work going on. And the change only in the last year as to what's available and the level of consciousness about these alternatives has been, you know, astounding to behold. So I'm optimistic the message is getting through. You know, people know about this food in a way they didn't. The web has also been very, very helpful. But we all have to get out and tell the story. You know, as much as we can, and lead by examples. I mean, the reason the chefs have played such an important role is they put this food in front of people, and people taste it, and they realize, mm-hmm. Wow, this stuff is so much better. And because there's, you know, one of the wonderful things about this movement is that it has pleasure and quality on its side. And, you know, when you have a taste of that local spinach, and I'll bet, you know, winter spinach from Wisconsin, you know, it's been exposed to the cold, it's got probably so much more flavor than anything you could truck in from California, that it will speak for itself. The challenge, of course, is also getting the price down to make it accessible to as many people as possible. And one of the things the big food industry has been good at has been forcing prices down. And they do have that advantage on their side, as well as the message machine.
Along those lines, thanks, Aaron, for the call. Vicki in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello. This does have something to do with my question is similar to that. And I don't shop at Walmart because I can afford to go to other places, although I do go buy cloth there because it's the only place in my local area where I can buy cloth. But I know that other people can't afford to go anywhere to Walmart. It's a systemic problem. It's an issue of employability. It's an issue of being employed at all for so many people. And I know that Walmart has moved into organic food. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little about all of that systemic stuff and whether that's reliable and whether people can count on what they buy organically there to be truly organic. Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's on balance a positive development that Walmart is offering organic food because it will help build the market for organic food, and it will make it accessible to people who could never afford it before. They will sell organic food as cheaply as it can be sold. They've promised to sell it at only like a 10% premium over conventional food. I actually don't think they can do that. I think they're going to be surprised. I worry that the way they will attempt to do that is to force down the prices to farmers. And, you know, that has been their history, right, which is, you know, to be the low-cost supplier, everyday low prices. But somebody has to takes the hit when you have everyday low prices, and it's usually their suppliers. You know, organic will get cheaper as it gets more efficiently distributed and the market grows. On the other hand, if it comes under the same, you know, ferocious pressure to get cheap, it won't be the same thing. Organic farmers will cut corners, and you will get into situations such as we now have with some organic milk. There are several large producers of organic milk that supply stores like Walmart that are organic only in name. I mean, these are huge feedlots where the cattle never get grass while they're milking, and they're fed a steady diet of grain. And, it's organic grain, but it's not what the consumer expects from organic milk, which should be milk that comes from animals that get to live outdoors when there's grass, you know, growing. So that's what I worry about, that there will be some dilution of the organic idea, and we have to defend against that. I mean, the fact is there are organic standards, they're federal, they're subject to political pressure, and we need to be vigilant about that. And already several battles have been fought, and there is a raging battle now to insist that organic milk come from pastured cows, and I think that it's a very important battle to fight. There's a group called the Cornucopia Institute that is fighting that battle, and it's very important to join them in you know, making sure the bar for what we call organic stays high.
Yeah, they're based in Wisconsin.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Paula in Monroe. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, actually listening to you, there's so much more I want to say now, but when we were listening to you last week, my kids insisted that I call and share with you a little bit of our experience. We moved to a farm about a year ago, and in that time we raised some pigs and we butchered and ate one. We ended up selling three others. Could have sold more, wanted to keep some for ourselves, but it was bar none the best pork we've ever had. Not fatty. It was tasty, raised outside on pasture, and it was just a really great experience. So talk about pleasure in the whole doing something healthy. It was there.
Yeah, well, you know, the other thing is, I'll bet that that pork had a very good diet. I'm sure you fed it table scraps and things. That kind of pork, we forget how good pork can be when it gets a good diet. And also it's a, you know, I mean, this sounds sentimental, but it's a happy animal that lives outdoors and gets to, you know, have its, you know, kind of creaturely instincts satisfied. That produces better meat. I mean, stressed out factory farmed pork is just not a very tasty product, and we shouldn't be surprised. Those animals did not live the way they were designed to live. You know, I'm jealous. I'm jealous of your pork.
Thanks, Paula, for calling. Steve in Decorah, Iowa. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Wondering what Michael thinks about the natural food stores and various places that have the organic potato chips and, quote, junk food. My contention is it would still be junk food, even though it's got that label. And well, secondly, when will it get to the point in our preventative health care system that the insurance companies ask not only do we smoke, but also are we eating three or four vegetables per day?
Well, I think that's a very good question. When they take an interest in that, I mean, you know, on the one hand, it'll be the nanny corporation at work. But on the other hand, it's true. People who eat well should get a break on their insurance because they have less chronic disease. So I can see the logic of that. Look, junk food is junk food. You know, if it's organic junk food, well, that's good for the environment, I suppose, but it's not going to be any better for your body. You know, if you're eating these, you know, highly salted, fatty, refined grain junk food products, because it's organic, it has a kind of aura of healthfulness around it, but that's completely false. So I would stay away from that stuff. You know, the great case study, of course, is, you know, what happens when organic Coca-Cola arrives? Now, you know, that will happen.
I'll buy it.
It may not be too far away. People will think it's somewhat healthier. They will be kidding themselves. But there will be certain advantages for the environment because there will be thousands of acres of organic cornfields necessary to support all that organic high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
But to tell yourself it's, you know, it's any healthier is kidding yourself.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. We had a tremendous response this hour. I'm sure you'll have quite a crowd in Milwaukee when you're here. And I did find some contact information, so I'll pass that along. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Yeah. Michael Pollan, Knight Professor of Journalism at Berkeley, author of many books, including The Omnivore's Dilemma. We were talking about his just published book, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. And Michael Pollan will be in Milwaukee at Alverno College on Monday night, January the 14th at 7 o'clock in an event sponsored by the Harry Schwartz Bookshop. You can get more information by calling the Alverno box office, area code 414-382-6044. 414-382-6044. Tickets are $30. That includes a copy of the book, In Defense of Food. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. Thanks to Leo Duran for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.